My name is Harvey Sickerman, and as president of the Foreign Policy Research Institute, it's my pleasure to welcome you here this afternoon to the 12th Templeton Lecture on Religion and Politics. You've heard this story before, but I'm going to say it again. It was some 12 years ago when, despite our resistance, Jack Templeton pushed us to start this lecture series. I want to tell you why we resisted. One was that professional diplomats, particularly in the Western countries, ever since the 30 Years' War, have wanted to exclude religion from diplomacy and politics on the grounds that it made diplomacy and politics impossible. On top of that, in the academic field, there weren't that many people who knew both subjects. There were those who knew religion and those who knew politics, and rarely did the two ever meet. So on this basis, we said to Jack, it's a great idea, but we'd rather not. And he said, yes, you would. His opinion prevailed. And fortunately, it did, because we got a head start on something that later on became a required subject for both diplomats and analysts. And we are very proud that over the 12 years, we've managed to find people who somehow or another knew both sides. And in its way, the Templeton Lecture Series has stimulated a good deal of research and thought on the subject matter. We had two criteria for it, the one being that it had to be up to scholarly standards, and the other that it had to look at the positive and not simply the negative consequences of the interplay between religion and politics. And thus far, I think we've been successful in doing so. And I have every confidence that tonight we will register a 12th success on this score. Our speaker tonight, Dr. Jasser, is the chairman of the board and founding member of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy. This was formed by a small group of local Phoenix Muslim professionals in March 2003 as a startup think tank in support of the expression of Islam, which is in synergy with American democracy and the Constitution and the clear separation of religion and state. Now, the man who started this, our speaker tonight, has a very interesting background. He's the son of Muslim Syrian immigrants, a native of Wisconsin, and he has also served in the United States Navy, and including in his service, he was the medical department head aboard the USS El Paso, which deployed in Somalia in 93 and 94. I was in the government at the time, and I remember very well the sequence that led up to it. He was also a staff internist for the Office of the Attending Physician to Congress in Washington. So you could see that he's accustomed, as they say in the Navy, to put himself in harm's way. He since moved into the private practice of internal medicine and nuclear cardiology, and as I mentioned to him before, he's a doctor, not a lawyer, but in the legal profession, they have a name for being both a Navy man and a doctor, and that's called double jeopardy. And especially now that he has entered into this very contentious subject as a devout practicing Muslim in looking at the intersection with American culture. He's been very active on that score, and he's been published in many places. He's also participated in a goodly number of interfaith movements, diversity dialogues, and he's actually been in a film, although the film has not yet been released, thanks to politics at the PBS, I think. Anyways, Dr. Jasser is a frequent columnist in some local and occasionally in the national media, and we're delighted to have him here today to deliver the 12th annual Templeton Lecture.
Thank you, Harvey. It's a pleasure to be here and an honor to follow the long line of speakers that I've seen. That I'm just humbled to be in their company, and I can tell you as I ventured into this intersection between religion and politics, it's not something that I necessarily chose. It's something that I felt was an obligation for me to start discussing publicly. And this was after 9/11. There were many pathologies that I've been dealing with within the Muslim community, and I thought that I could continue to deal with them internally. But after 9/11, as I began to see some of the self-appointed spokespeople for my faith, I determined that it was not something that I could take silently from my home or from my living room. So we formed the organization that Harvey mentioned to you, and I'll talk to you about that as I go through. But I think that when you look at, and again, we talked this morning about how prescient it was for Dr. Templeton to begin this topic years before 9/11, and that we see that the world, I think, today, as we try to figure out this conflict that we're under, slowly now, as we are almost 7 years, but as we finish 6 years since 9/11, we're starting to figure out that terrorism is just a tactic, and that the tactic has a goal, it has a mission, it has a dream. And that terrorism is simply a means to an end. And that the only way to defeat a tactic is to defeat either the source completely or to take away the dreams of the enablers. And those dreams, when they're wedded to religion, become the biggest liability for those of us that have embarrassment in even talking about religion and politics. So what greater incendiary mechanism to manipulate Western society than to cover a fascistic dream in a faith that is a spiritual path for over a billion people? And what better way to insulate itself from criticism than to cover itself in a spiritual path? And that's really the dilemma that many of us have had in the West, Muslim and non-Muslim, is that we have always been protective of our faith, and our Constitution and our First Amendment have guided us that way. And one of my heroes that I've read about and grew to love and admire in my family tradition was always Thomas Jefferson, and that the respect for religion and the protection of the practice of faith is really enabled by our founding fathers, and especially if you look at the Virginia Statute on Religious Freedom that Thomas Jefferson had written. Really ingrained in our society a respect for the free practice of religion. And Thomas Jefferson said that the legitimate powers of government extend to such acts only as they are injurious to others. It does me no injury for my neighbor to say there are 20 gods or no god. It is neither picks my pocket nor breaks my leg. And this idea that a person's personal relationship between God and his are his own, his or her own, and not the role of government to impose upon him, is basically one of the main quarrels that the Islamists and the those that ideologically feed the terrorists have with the West. And unfortunately, one of the things I often tell audiences that I speak to is that I think that our first step as Americans is that we have forgotten what it is to be an American. We have forgotten that America's ideology, America as a nation, was founded by people that were escaping religious persecution. And I'll tell you that as we start to look back at understanding our ideas, and that America is not just a flag, America is not our media or MTV or rock and roll or blue jeans, America is an idea of religious freedom and political freedom and the freedom to be and achieve what you want with equal access to every individual in society. That access is not dictated by wealth, it's not dictated by religion, or by any other immutable characteristic. And that is actually what the Islamists fear the most. And when I talk about Islamists, what do I mean? There are some that feel that Islamist means terrorist. It doesn't. The simple condemnation of terror does not make someone necessarily compatible with American and Western ideals. Condemnation of terror, I believe, simply brings you to the table of humanity, in that you don't believe in the targeting of women and children and non-combatants and ununiformed people in the achievement of a political end. But what are those political ends? And as I see it, the root cause of terrorism is actually the dreams of the political Islamic State. Now, that political Islamic State, we need to understand what that is. There's the fascistic state that believes in the totalitarian or authoritarian imposition of Islamic law throughout society. And then there's the democratic state of Islam, which believes in parliaments, elections, and discourse and debate. But these two different types of government share the identification of being an Islamic state because the source of law is the same. The source of law they view is the Quran and the tradition or the Sunnah of the Prophet. Now, certainly I use that tradition in my personal life, my last will and testament, my family's marriage, my wife and I's book of marriage, our contract, marital contract, is all based on religious law. But that's something we chose in our own home. To transfer that into government then empowers clerics to be the only ones really that can have access to law, that can have access to legislation and access to public and legal discourse. Or if a non-cleric wants to have access, then they have to go and become schooled in Sharia law. And that is the problem. And I'll tell you, as much as the movement and the Forward Middle East Initiative to democratization is important, I think we're missing the boat if we think that we're going to solve the problems in the Middle East by simply getting them to have elections and parliaments. We need to start to bring forth an idea of freedom and liberty and the fact that we respect individuals in America over sometimes the community. And that principle is really one that came in the postmodern era and in the era of enlightenment that the West went through. And that until Muslims can start to feel that their faith is not threatened by enlightenment and a respect for the individual, I don't believe that we're going to win this war. And I say war, there's wars on the battlefield, and there's wars of ideas, wars in intellectual discourse. And it's interesting that sometimes when we present these ideas, we present it behind a flag, behind our American flag, which certainly I joined the military to defend. But even more so, I think that we need to understand that just because somebody's patriotic does not make them necessarily looking out for the best interests of freedom and liberty in America. They may have a vision, for example, Islamic organizations that purport to represent Muslims may have a vision for America which simply takes our flag and adds a little crescent onto it and wants to make it into an Islamic state. Now, my colleagues in the Muslim community will say that I'm fear-mongering and that this is, exaggeration. I would ask you to, basically, when you walk away from here, I believe that one of the primary steps to understanding this conflict is to engage the Muslim community, not allow them to circle the wagons and rally themselves behind victimization, but actually engage them on these ideas of the role of religious law in public life. Because I think you will find that while the vast majority of Muslims have assimilated and reformed their own practices by virtue of the way that they live in America, I think ideologically often they've not been given the freedom, they've been given the freedom but not the means and the test and the challenge to understand what it is that they're living day to day. And as a result, if you were to simply go to bookshelves and look at Islamic texts, most of it is pre-14th century. Most of the Islamic texts that talk about law that guides punishment for criminal activity, civil activity, etc., is 14th century law at best. Could be 11th, 12th century. And that's why you see a lot of corporal punishment, severing of hands for stealing, which is still part of Saudi law. You see the stoning of women that you see as part of violation of marital laws, etc. This to Americans in the West is barbaric. And yet the religious law hasn't been reformed or advanced to get to the 21st century. So am I an expert in these things? I'm proud to say actually that I'm not an imam. And I think that that's something that should at this point, unfortunately, in many ways it gives me credibility, because I think one of the primary problems with Islamic Reformation issues is the clerical leadership and the imams. Just look at culturally. If you talk to a Muslim family, most of them will want to sit down after you tell them that their son or daughter may want to go into theology and study becoming a cleric or an imam. It's not of the same tenor or value to a family as wanting to study medicine or law or engineering. So clearly, the intellectual hold upon religious theological discussion of jurisprudence in faith has been given over to less than the intellectuals in society. And that's one of the problems. If you look at my story, as Harvey mentioned, my family came to America not for economic reasons. They came here for ideological reasons. They escaped Syria. My grandfather had, after the French pulled out, tried to be part of the democratization of Syria, and actually they did have a democracy there for a few years. And then, unfortunately, as we saw in many Middle Eastern countries, coup after coup happened in the early 50s until finally you had the establishment of the strongest military coup there by the Ba'athists, and ultimately Hafez Assad took power. I cannot underscore enough how much deeply wedded there is a relationship between the secular dictatorships of the Middle East and radical Islam and the Islamist threat in the world. They may seem to be diametrically opposed entities, but if you look at the history and the evolution of radical Islamist or theocratic movements, it has been an equal and opposite reaction to the dictatorships in the Middle East, whether it's from monarchies in Saudi Arabia and the Wahhabists that came out of them, or it's the dictatorships in Egypt with the Muslim Brotherhood, or in Syria with also elements of the Muslim Brotherhood that also fed Hamas in Israel. And you'll see this in Iran, etc., with the Shah initially in power that then empowered the radical Islamist movement. All of this is very symmetrical, and that's why you will not solve, I'll tell you from generations of family that have been fighting for democratization and anti-theocracy in the Middle East, that you will not be able to modernize, to bring Islam into modernity without the removal of many of these governments. Now, do we need to do it militarily? No, I don't think so. We changed Eastern Europe without invading any of those countries, and we defeated communism without invading Russia. But we need to turn our attention to it. We need to turn our attention to the dissidents. We need to turn our attention to those that believe in freedom and liberty, not only democracy. I actually think that in the short term, if we wed ourselves to democratic movements only, we may end up seeing ourselves usher in parliaments that are based on Quranic law and actually have facilitated the establishment of Islamic states that, in the end of the day, may in short term be more peaceful to us from a strategic standpoint. But in the long term, I think it'll end up dividing the world into a triangular fashion of China, Islamic states, and the secular Western states. Basically, that's the conflict. The conflict is between what is the source of law? Is it the Constitution and natural law versus Sharia? Or the conflict of the lay individual versus the clerics? Or the conflict of the individual versus tribalism or Muslim collectivism? Any way you say it, that conflict should become clearer to you as we start to understand what is plaguing the Muslim community. And as I have, through my life, been active in the Muslim community, I've tried to go to prayer every Friday. I attend the Ramadan holiday prayers and have constantly, not all the time, but probably, I'll tell you, 70-80% of the time found mosques that were not about spirituality, not about teaching children morality and character and integrity and service, etc., and humility, but rather about politics, about domestic and foreign policy, about issues that actually, I believe, have nothing to do with my relationship with God, but rather about things on this earth. And actually, my responses in many of the debates I've tried to have with imams to no avail is to tell them that if God wanted us to discuss these things, the Quran would have been filled with injunctions about how to run government. And there's actually nothing in the Quran about how we should run government. But yet, they will take passages that do talk about war, for example, and transpose them out of context, which I believe is about history more than it is about religion. And ultimately, back to my story, I'll tell you, this is a conflict that I've had way before 9/11. I remember in 1993, I was on leave from the military. I was simply going to an Islamic Medical Association meeting. One of the only other Muslim medical officers was the head of endocrinology at Bethesda. And he and I decided to take leave and go present a paper on hormonal regulation and some endocrine issues at the Islamic Medical Association. It happened to be attached to the Islamic Society of North America annual meeting, and I had never been to an ISNA meeting. This is actually the largest Muslim organization in America. Their annual meetings are about 20,000, 30,000 Muslims, activists that meet. The keynote address was given by an individual by the name of Siraj Wahaj, who is originally with Nation of Islam and then converted to Sunni Islam, and gave the keynote address. And we were sitting there, and I'm listening to this gentleman talk, and very, very magnetic preacher-type personality, and listening, and we sort of pulled into it. Next thing I know, he was talking about the Constitution. And he picks up the Quran and says, you know, I was on an airplane, and imagine a Jewish passenger sitting next to me asked me if Muslims became a majority America, if we would replace the U.S. Constitution with the Quran. And he laughed with this, you know, jugular laugh and said, can you imagine somebody wondering if a document made by humans would be superior to a document made by God? And I got lightheaded, actually. I sat down, and after he was done, I went to the podium. I went to the questions, the mics, and I said, I'm not sure if you understand American law, but you have just violated my understanding of the Sedition Act, and you're free to disagree with foreign policy and domestic policy, but you cannot talk about the total overthrow of the U.S. Constitution and the replacement by another document. And I asked other people in the audience that happened to be from the military to make sure that they left because they're violating their oath to this country. And it was in some ways traumatic for me. I had just joined the Navy. But yet they felt that I was overreacting. And I think that it's not an overreaction. I think that this is the difference in that there are certain things that we have to know as a community and as a nation that take priority over other things. There was a German judge recently that gave a man the right to beat his wife because he told the judge that this is out of his religious law, that he is allowed to domestically abuse his wife. And, you know, that's not in any way the Islam I was taught. But for us to be living in society where once somebody raises the flag of religion, we then stop critiquing it, and we then stop holding them accountable to values that we share as a community, I think is the day that we begin down the slope of defeat. But as much as, you know, some of the Muslims will say that I'm mischaracterizing ISNA and that's too harsh, I think that it's important to have the debate. It's interesting, even though I made that public statement, 5 years later I met my wife and her family in Cleveland, and they said, gosh, you know, I told them about this story. They said, geez, we were there. We saw you say that. But yet nobody really did anything. Nobody stood up and agreed with me. Nobody actually then said, maybe we have a problem. And this was in 1993. That same gentleman, by the way, then became an unindicted co-conspirator in the 93 bombing of the World Trade Center. And the issue is that when you address these things, there's a tribal mentality that somehow individuals that want to create an advancement and critique the ideas of the tribal leaders, and that's really what it is I would tell you that the Islamic community has reverted back to pre-Islamic Arabia. It has reverted back to a tribalism that has lost its values. Terrorism is nothing more. Anytime you take an idea in which the ends justifies the means, it is basically corruption. Izetbegović, who was the president of Bosnia-Herzegovina, said that he was never more Muslim than when he was in solitary confinement under Tito for 15 years. So therefore, a Muslim must hear that and say that my rights and my freedoms in society are not related to me being Muslim. I actually have more time to sit and talk to God and be closer to God when I have absolutely no rights and I'm sitting in solitary confinement. So therefore, my religion and my piety towards God is unrelated to this earth. And that actually the idea that we should be selling, not on Al Hura, which actually gets the ratings of the Oxygen Channel in Iraq, we should be actually selling this idea on Al Jazeera. We should be selling it on Syrian TV and demanding that we be bringing this idea, which is that the mechanism for an individual to be most close to God is actually to live in a laboratory of freedom. Is that when you live in a laboratory where people around you are sinning, where people around you are not fasting in Ramadan, where people around you are not deciding to pray their five times a day, and then when I choose to step away from the group and go pray on my own, not in the middle of a gate at the airport demanding for everybody to see me, but actually on my own, that actually is more of a demonstration to the God of Abraham that I'm choosing to do that of my own free will. And thus, the day of judgment, if you believe in a day of reckoning, thus has more meaning to God. And that's actually, I think, the message of our founding fathers, is that the most pious nation, the most pious individuals are those that can freely decide whether to act or to practice their faith without coercion from government. And that actually religion, however, now Muslims will say, well, Zuhdi, listen, this is ridiculous. You don't want religion to inspire what we do? And I think this is another caveat that I tell you, is I would be careful. There's always this equivalency where you hear, well, they then give me 10 other religious lobbies in America that mix religion and politics, supposedly. I will tell them that there is absolutely no comparison. There's no moral equivalency between religiously inspired political groups and Islamist groups that have a construct of law that's nucleus is completely different from one based on a human document. So it's very different. The key is that we hold Muslims accountable to what they would view the construct of law would be if they became a majority. And last I checked, almost every Christian group or Buddhist group or Hindu group, they don't want to bring back, for example, canon law into American legal jurisprudence. But yet they may be empowered and inspired by their faith, which is very different. And I would then remember de Tocqueville, who said that military dictatorships do not need God, but democracies and lands based on freedom do need God. Because as you know, in the Middle East, and we see this in Iraq, in that when countries have lost their values and become corrupt, and this is really the problem in the Middle East, is that actually there's such a loss of values, that corruption has guided and taken over that society. And as a result, you have the wanton destruction when you have lawlessness, and the only thing that would control that society is some form of martial law. So there is a sense that you need to transition states from oppression to freedom, but that transition needs to be done inculcated with values. So ultimately, at the end of the day, if we believe that those values that they're going to use to drive their ideas are going to be based on morality, that morality has to come from somewhere. If it's not going to come from Islam, then we're going to say that we're going to have to convert over 1 billion people into a different faith. And that's not going to work. So then we're going to have to say that that source of values is going to have to be their faith of Islam that we believe is a message from the God of Abraham to Muslims. But that message has to be put in a way that's consistent with modernity and pluralism. In the last few minutes, I want to leave you with a few thoughts on what do we do as a Western society within our community, and then what do we do, especially non-Muslims and other organizations, to help this process along and move it along faster than the 500 years of stagnancy that we've been under. First of all, as far as in our own societies, I would tell you that we need to be cautioned about putting up the roadblocks to parallel societies, parallel courts such as Sharia courts, where Muslims are given the freedom, quote-unquote, to set up their own legal court system. And that may be part of something that you may feel is appropriate for America, is to allow them to have their own court system. But I would tell you that that would become an incubator for Islamism and actually radical Islamism, because what happens is, and if you look in Canada, they tried this. The most vocal voice against Sharia courts in Canada were the Muslim women. Second, we see many examples. We saw the taxi cabs in Minneapolis, where these taxi cabs wanted to be separated from the society, to not carry people that were carrying alcohol, to not, you know, somehow impose their values upon the passengers they picked up. And I think that, as some may say, that, well, making a lot out of these issues is just exaggerating. You know, you need to just lighten up, Zuhdi, is what I'm told. I tell them that, listen, every opportunity I have to demonstrate examples, or in medicine as we call them, pathognomonic examples of the pathology of Islamism, I will exploit that, because they are doing the same thing. They are exploiting victimization issues. They are exploiting victimization politics to use what we have now been calling lawfare to get us distracted, to sue their individuals that are actually the biggest threat to their ideas, so that we're so busy fighting lawsuits, such as the Flying Imam case, which I could talk to you about, but to distract us to actually continue to divide society between Muslim and non-Muslim and to allow the continued inculcation of the Islamist ideology. A good example is Carver Elementary School in San Diego wanted to take its students and give it a third of them who are Muslim to move the lunchtime from 12:30 to 1:30 so that they could have their prayers. And I wrote a column and on CNN talked about the fact that, you know, listen, many of us grew up in elementary public schools praying and doing our own practices of faith without asking for the entire school to change its time schedule. And that you can step away during a break, you might be a few minutes late, and certainly I would not want schools to prevent Muslims from praying. They should give them the space to pray if they need it, but because that's a personal faith practice. But once that personal faith practice crosses the line into society and starts changing the schedule of the general society, or changing the cost to general society, to the taxpayers, as we saw with the foot bath incidents, where the University of Michigan was paying $30,000 to install foot baths. I don't have a problem with private funding for that. If they need it, fine. But taxpayers' money, then they should have then allotted $30,000 for every other faith group in that university at the same time. And that's what America is all about. Accommodation of Muslim issues is when I was growing up in the 70s, I don't remember any time Muslims asking for these things. It's almost become a tool of segregation and separating Muslims from non-Muslims so that they can continue this issue of minority politics. And it's becoming very potent, and we allow it to take over the debate. And what I say is actually it soaks up the bandwidth of American attention to actually where we should be fighting for freedom, which is that Islamic organizations today only come to notoriety because of America's fear of terrorism. If terrorism tomorrow disappeared, nobody would care about foot baths, they wouldn't care about schedules in schools, etc. The reason why most of the attention to Islam is happening is because of terrorism. So it's sort of like if a patient comes into my office tomorrow and has lung cancer, and I spend my whole time focusing on their cholesterol, their headaches, and every other issue, but I don't focus on the lung cancer. And it's the same thing with terrorism, is that the Muslim community, I think, for credibility, needs to start focusing most of its resources on the root cause of terrorism. And the root cause of terrorism, that tactic, is political Islam. The methods of reform, I think, are manyfold. I'll leave you just sort of with my list of reformation steps. I think that we need to, number one, when you leave here, engage the Muslim community on these issues. Get informed about the difference between Sharia law and constitutional law. And start to have panels of discussion, not with the interfaith kumbaya discussions that legitimizes most Muslim communities, leaders, and yet, you know, it's amazing, actually, and thanks to Frank Gaffney for connecting me with Templeton and others, and that's why I'm here. But I'll tell you that after his film was shown on Fox News a couple weeks ago, the imam, who's one of my main adversaries in Phoenix, in that documentary claims that I'm a liberal extremist and then goes on to say, he wouldn't even say my name in the documentary, goes on to say that people like him think that we can, you know, somehow separate religion and politics, and that people like him don't want to acknowledge that every Muslim wants to live under Islamic State and under Sharia law. And I'll tell you, there's actually one interfaith celebration that was set up that was canceled that I know about in Phoenix. So people are starting to understand that there's this veneer of moderation that sort of, they know how to play the game outside the mosque, but then these organizations that supposedly represent the Muslim community and demand civil rights, I would ask you when you leave here, ask them, say, okay, you want to be able to pray openly, loudly at a gate, what do you do in your mosque if a non-Muslim wants to visit? What do you do in your mosque? How do you treat women internally in the mosque? Are they allowed to be on the board of directors? What type of civil rights do the Muslims in your mosque have amongst each other? And the hypocrisy is just so deep. And I would say that that's a loss of Islamic values. I would say that that's actually a corruption and a hypocrisy that needs to be exposed, and it needs the sunshine treatment. Because ultimately, these institutions will disappear, you know, faster than anything, that once they start to be exposed to the regular American community that pays attention to hypocrisy. So ultimately, the Muslim community needs to be held accountable to its concept of ummah. Ummah is a word that's very prevalent in the Quran. Ummah in Arabic means nation. It means community, but it also basically means nation. So when an imam talks about ummah in Arabic and in his sermons, that's a threatening concept, actually, because you then wonder, at what point does an American Muslim follow the needs of the Muslim nation versus the needs of the American nation to which they are a citizen? And that, what I would say, needs the Muslim community needs to de-ummatize itself to really circumscribe the mechanism by which the ummah is important. And I would circumscribe it to our study of theology and learning about the Quran and scripture, to charity, that obviously all of our faiths need to be able to give charity within our community, socialization. Obviously, marriage within the faith is something all of our faiths try to do. And then lastly is facilitating our hajj, our pilgrimage, and other aspects of practice and spirituality and mosques and community worship. But other than that, politics, government, civic service, etc., you'll find organizations like the Muslim American Society now is involved in Boy Scouts in every chapter in America. That's the method of the Muslim Brotherhood. You find that Islamic Society of North America and a lot of these organizations weave themselves into other civic groups, which I believe should never be part of my Muslim identity. Next, I think, is that we change the dreams. And I think it's very important when Harvey mentioned that one of the goals of these lectures is to leave with a positive thing, is that the dreams of most Muslims today, and I would say most, maybe it's not most, but I think the dreams of most Muslims is still wedded because they have come from oppression and dictatorships. Most of their dreams are religious because the mosque was the last institution where they had a little bit of freedom of speech. As long as they didn't speak against their own government, they were allowed to speak against every other government in the world. But if you talk to those in Syrian mosques, they'll tell you that as long as they didn't speak against the Ba'athists and the Syrian government, the mosques were sort of this haven of freedom of speech. And that's why the Muslim Brotherhood took over most of the mosques. That's why the Wahhabis were able to spread text into most of the mosques in the world, to the tune of $80 billion that they spent on spreading the word of Wahhabism. They were able to inculcate this literature into a lot of the mosques under the guise of most of these dictatorships. But we need to change those dreams from dreams of the utopian caliphate or Islamic states that bring them supposedly Islamic freedom to dreams of Western individual freedom where access to government and access to society is open to all. I would say that you could help further by helping us network. If you see Muslim leaders, Muslim business leaders, I think most of this is going to come from the business community that can take over the religious community and tell them this is how it's going to be done. This is the education and the academia that we're going to have. I think that that's key. Is next, to help us establish institutions. I think if you look at Western Enlightenment happened with the establishment of Enlightenment institutions, classical liberalism, institutions that queried the church, that queried government, and began to question authority. And then also to hold some litmus tests and standards for the Muslims that you will engage with, organizationally speaking, to say that they need to recognize Israel as a state, to say that they need to stand against radical Islamist groups by name, not just by theory, not by tactic or condemning terrorism, but by name, naming Hamas and Al-Qaeda and other groups. I think that if they don't have the moral courage to name the Saudis and to name the Syrian government as an oppressive dictatorship, then you have to wonder where their allegiances are. These types of litmus tests, I think, are not being done enough even by our own government and the people that they attach themselves with. We need help in what I would call a counter-jihad. It's still at its early mitotic cell divisions. I mean, my organization, the American Islamic Forum, is still very early in its founding, but is I have now another Muslim that works with me part-time and some others behind the scenes that are on our board and otherwise. But again, there's so many aspects affecting the ability of Muslims to really contribute and get involved because of fear. Moderates are actually the first to be attacked because of tribalism, because of a lack of knowledge. I'll tell you that there's probably more people in this room that understand Sharia law than in most of the Muslim groups that I've spoken to. And that's sad, actually, but it's because the reins of understanding intellectual theology in Islam were just given up by most of the Muslim community. So we need to live that. And last, I'll leave you with another quotation that talks about the patience with which revolutions happen. This is from Jefferson also, that the generation which commences a revolution rarely completes it. Habituated from their infancy to passive submission of body and mind to their kings and priests, they are not qualified when called on to think and provide for themselves, and their inexperience, their ignorance, and their bigotry make them instruments, often in the hands of the Bonapartes and the Interbides, to defeat them and defeat their own rights and purposes. And this was in 1823, almost 40, 50 years after our country was founded. Jefferson was talking about the fact that, and probably as much as he certainly didn't change slavery, you know, you look at this room that Lincoln is such a big part of this institution, and Lincoln said it best when he said that America is the world's last greatest hope for mankind. And I think that we have to remember the ideas that America stands for. We have to remember that there are millions, I believe, of Muslims that came here because of those ideas. And if we tell them that Islam is the problem, we will not win this war. Thank you.
We're open for some questions. The usual rule applies. Got a question, ask it. Got a speech, don't give it. And I'd ask you to approach the microphone, and you can identify yourself, so if we don't like the question, we won't invite you the next time.
Ronald Ziegler. Doctor, the magnitude of the problem of engaging the Pew Trust poll, 25% of United States Muslims sympathize with suicide bombing. Were you surprised at that result, and how has that attitude affected your efforts?
I think there were a lot of positive things too, but the negative things did jump out at me the most. Is if you do the math, 26% of those under 30 in that poll sympathized with terrorism, and actually, what worried me the most is 40% of Arabs in the poll acknowledged that Al-Qaeda exists. So that tells you that 60% are still wallowing in conspiracy theories. And if there's any message in that, it should tell you that what most of the Arabic American community and the Muslim American community are watching is Al Jazeera, is that they're watching, they're not watching our media, and that they haven't engaged with American, you know. And one of the things I tell them is when Abu Ghraib came out, and gosh, if you watch Al Jazeera, which I do with the right medications on board, is, you know, I'm kidding, by the way, is you realize it's a psychiatric experiment in propaganda. They reshow the same images in very different ways, and it does change ideas, and it changes perceptions. So we need to figure out, America is, if there's anything we're an expert at, it's campaigning. But yet, one of our greatest campaigners, Karen Hughes, went to public diplomacy and basically did very little in that we, you know, I think fairly, it's a fair critique to say that we haven't changed that many hearts and minds. And it's because the tools that we're using are not on their playing field. We're using other ones. Then they're still propagating their conspiracy theories. The reason those conspiracy theories work is because when I was in the military, I didn't meet that many other Muslims in the officers' ranks. Certainly in the enlisted, there were quite a few. But in the officers' ranks, there weren't that many. So when they're over the hookah or over the in the mosque talking about Islamic, Arabic, American foreign policy, the stereotypes and the conspiracies are going to propagate because not one of them has met government officials in a active co-working kind of way. So there's still a lot of segregation, and that's how conspiracies continue to flow. The ideology, I think, is important too, and that's where I think that when 26% of youth, corruption is pretty rampant, and they haven't really learned, I believe, Islamic values. So to them, if they have a political grievance, why not excuse terror? Because it's a means, and that tells me that corruption and moral courage from Islamic leaders hasn't been heard. Yes.
First of all, thank you very much for being very frank and being willing to say what so many others are totally unwilling to say. And you are probably risking your life in doing so. If you have not been threatened, I'd be very, very much surprised. But you're trying to make the plea that Muslims on their own, as things stand, can be persuaded that they can accommodate to the modern world. However, the history, the texts, the Quran, the Hadiths, the Sirah, do not give them very good persuasive arguments. I've read 20 books at least, one of which I got as a result of a lecture here, that when they examine all the texts, they say, gee, these people, as long as they accept the Quran and the Hadiths and the Sirah, cannot reconcile it with civil law, the modern world, which is the key of your reconciliation. How all the texts say you're apostate, and how can you convince the world that you are not apostate, that these wackos that are they're called wackos, but they can quote all the scripture, all the history, all the four schools of Islamic jurisprudence, everybody from the 7th century to today?
Yeah, I think that's a great question, and that's probably the most difficult question to answer. And all I would say is to look back at Christian Reformation of canon law and the separation in that. If you look at the way Muslims practice today, the theory of apostasy, et cetera, is not practiced by Muslims. I know many Muslims that have left the faith, and none of my friends thought they were apostates that should be killed. It's just not part of the way that Muslims practice their compassionate humanitarian faith. But yet the text and the law doesn't say. It says what you say. So the issue is that the Quran itself in Arabic, I don't believe says what you say. I believe, for example, if you take apostasy, actually the only passage that comes close to defending apostasy and the punishment for apostasy is one that actually, I believe, has context of military allegiance. When I was in the Navy, when we were in Somalia, if I decided to tell my CEO, sorry, you know what, I know I have a 4-year agreement, but I'm leaving. You know, I'm done. I want to go back home. You can't do that in the military. You're told that you sign an agreement, you have either an unauthorized absence or you're a deserter. And desertion, actually, even in today's free world, has very strict punishments. So most of the rules of apostasy that come from Sharia are actually inappropriately extrapolated from rules of desertion of the Muslim military at the time of the Prophet. If you take away Muslim military desertion issues, it should be completely freedom of conscience, and they were mixing the Prophet's hat, where he wore the hat as the head of state, general of a military, and also messenger and prophet. And I'll tell you, there is no examples that I can give you of the ideology that I'm telling you today, other than the fact that Muslims need to think out of the box and use Western enlightenment as an example of how these societies are better than societies driven by religious identity specifically. They would call me kafar, which means infidel, but I think at the end of the day, you can argue that somebody who believes in God, that practices faith and fasts and prays, is not only a Muslim but a devout one at that, and that government ideology has nothing to do with that. But all of these things need to be worked out. But probably, unfortunately, for the intellectuals, which most of you are in this room, you want the text to be fixed, but that's probably going to be the last thing that gets fixed. The first step is to take away the reins of control from these Islamists, to separate religion and politics, and then lock the imams and the clerics in a room and tell them, you guys have to figure this out, figure out the Arabic text over the next generation, and fix the law problems, because our society, you need to catch up to society. Yes, Doctor.
Jack Templeton, thank you, Dr. Jasser, for coming so far. This is an important message, and I appreciate the depth that you've given to it. It indicates to me that much of what you're talking about is culture. And I think you suggested that there's elements of assimilation of Muslims who've come to America, which may be economic integration, assimilation, but I'm not sure there's been cultural assimilation. So I wanted to ask you to talk a bit more about the culture of Islamicism in two ways. First, the culture of personal privilege over and above anyone else's rights or values, that is, above what the law might say is applying to everyone. And secondly, the culture of an honor society, which places the right of personal retribution for perceived wrong versus the ordered equality before the law as applying to all persons. So it has to do with the concept of a privilege above and beyond what everybody else has as common rights.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Templeton. There's one other aspect that he just reminded me of Reformation that's very important, is that there are two things. One is that I was raised to believe that at the day of reckoning that I would only be accountable for my sins as an individual. If a Muslim believes that you can interpret passages in the Quran to say that the entire community is going to be held accountable and that God would then punish an entire community, whether it was Mother Teresa or whoever, no matter how good their life is, if they lived in a sinful community, that they would also be punished, you then have a theological argument for coercion and values. So one of the main Reformation parts is that Muslims acknowledge that, and this is clear, this is easy for me to do in the Quran, is for Muslims to acknowledge that society would never be punished as a whole for the sins of each individual. That's first of all. And that then gets the respect of the individual over the community. And the next part of Reformation, I think, is the exclusivistic part. Now, the exclusivist part, you could still argue that there are many faiths, including Christianity, that may feel that they, at the end of the day, they want to hold on to an exclusivist interpretation. But I was raised to believe that if somebody believed in God and they were, quote-unquote, people of the book, that we did not have a monopoly on heaven. And that the interpretation of the belief in the God of Abraham is not a single pathway to heaven, and that others are then infidels, etc. This was not the interpretation that I was taught. But I do believe part of that process that Jack mentioned is for Muslims to start abandoning the exclusivist interpretation. But as far as the personal privilege, it really has to do with a supremacist argument in that the quote-unquote, the class in society among Muslims that really is problematic is what they call the ulama, or the scholars of society. I don't know how all of a sudden somebody gets that secret handshake and they become a scholar, but it seems that there are many scholars that impose their values and they speak and the people follow. And I remember when I was young asking my mom, I was like, how did this guy all of a sudden become somebody who can decide how I interpret my faith? It didn't make sense to me, but that secret handshake of personal privilege is a tribal thing. It's really part of the tribalism. It was something that I believe, the whole reason I believe theologically Muslims, when we pray, put our heads on the ground and bow in deep humility, is because God was trying to break the deep arrogance and tribalism that had been part of the Arabic community that Islam came to correct. The honor killings, it's interesting, in Syria, my mother told me when they were there in the 60s, they had never heard of honor killings. And now it seems to be part of the community. It seems to be more prevalent. Not a big part, but it is increasing. So I'll tell you that the aspects of retribution, it's interesting. I actually spoke to a jurist from Jordan who told me that Jordanian law still actually almost dismisses somebody. They know of a case where a brother killed his sister for adultery, and it didn't even go to trial. So this is something that we need to be holding accountable, that countries that we do work with, that we interact with, and that we share ideas with need to be held accountable for this type of tribal ideology that I believe is not only un-Islamic, but it's inhuman and it needs to be corrected. But the way to do it is from an Islamic position of morality, and it can be done. Yes.
Thank you. Abigail Rosenthal. Dr. Jesser, I'd like to thank you so much for your talk, and I'm, of course, as many in this room must be, particularly struck by your courage, and that prompts my question, how much courage, could you gauge it for us, is required of the individual Muslim who rises to the kind of summons that you have extended today?
I appreciate the question. You know, I'll tell you, I would just deflect any of that courage to God's grace and gift for giving me the ability to do this. And it's almost a lot of times outweighed, as my wife would say, by the inappropriate inflation of the ego. But the courage is something that I, again, would say is really more my family's courage. I think that they're not doing any of this. They don't get too many compliments and thanks. And yet, I think that ultimately, the fear is there, but it's not been anything that I've actually directly felt. I've never been physically threatened. I certainly get my share of hate mail, calling me an Uncle Tom, a sellout, a part of the Zionist conspiracy, part of every conspiracy theory known to man. I got an email from MD PhD of neurosurgery from a state that's in the East Coast 2 weeks ago, telling me that, you know, that he wanted to know whose payroll I'm on, and I must not be doing well in the medical field, and that's why I'm doing this. And it's just, you know, I get a lot of crazy, crazy comments of people that just are in such denial. And that's why I really think the Muslim community needs a 12-step program. You know, it really needs to start with first getting rid of the denial, acknowledging what our problems are, apologizing to everybody that we've hurt, and then moving forward, just like the 12-step program that I take my patients through sometimes, and acknowledging that we need to fix our house first before we can start complaining about the impact that others have had. And I think that then builds credibility. It builds a respect. Courage is one of these things that they'll say about somebody in their epitaph, but in present present tense, it's... Thank you.
My name is Charles Harper. I want to thank you, Dr. Jasser, for your wonderful speech, and most importantly, for stepping forward to do what you're doing. I want to draw you out on something that you said that really caught my imagination. Strategists have been talking to me and others for years about how the most important thing that could happen within global Islam is for people like you to step forward. That is, people that are often in the private world, they're business people, they have lived in the world of liberty, they understand it, they like it, and they have also lived a spiritual life, as you have. They have preserved that in a culture of liberty. So your comment was this. You said that there's a challenge to draw forward Muslim business people into a public activity. So my question to you is, what could be done about this? If more people like you were to step forward, say thousands of Muslim leaders, busy people, caring for their families, running businesses, not used to being public spokespersons, advocates, activists, academics, but the kind of people that are out there that are like you, perhaps a little more timid, how could you bring them into a network? How could you cultivate their public activity? How could their message be brought into a kind of active strategic network and communicated to Muslims around the world? How could something practically be done to take your idea and move it forward?
Thank you for that, and I think it's very important in that I think the way to do that is for us to realize that that's a goal, and I think you compare it to how we fought communism. I think in the 50s we said, you know, what are we going to do? And I wasn't here then, but, you know, what are we going to do to fight this ideology that threatens America? And I think today you see large institutions that have been established on the premise of fighting an idea, whether it's Heritage, American Enterprise, Brookings. All these institutions were built on the premise of defeating global communism and socialism. And we have won most of that war, and the communist states that remain are on the retreat still. So I think that the way to do that is to empower Muslims that you know to reach out to individuals like me. My biggest impediment is that in some ways I'm a hypocrite in that I say that we should separate religion and politics, and yet the vehicle of my entry into the public life has been religion in some ways. Though I'll tell you, I just finished a year as president of the Arizona Medical Association, so I certainly didn't need this to be politically active. But the idea is to tell them that, you know, as I was telling Harvey today at lunch, it's like I tell them that, no, I'm not a hypocrite. I want to get into the pig pen, into the mud pile, clean it up, and get out of there. And I think that's the issue, is that we need to build institutions that begin to inculcate an ideology that we can separate that. And if you know Muslims in the business community, tell them there's many levels of involvement. There's financial involvement, which is the first step in building infrastructure. And it doesn't only have to be Muslim financial involvement. I think we have to understand that many communities have had interfaith support when they realize that global stability depends on those that have and understand helping those that have not or that don't understand and don't get it. So part of it's financial. The next part is a network and connecting individuals together. The next part is creating debates and forums to to raise these issues, but there's only so much feelers that I can put out to wake up the Muslim community. Many of you and others, and I think part of it's going to be a media campaign. I foresee a time when you see Muslims and Arabs on TV ads, on television, saying that, you know, stop using Arabic oil, stop using Saudi oil, because what's killing the Muslim mind is the natural resource, and that they're not using the best natural resources, which is between their ears. And I think ultimately I like to see a marketing campaign where every time an Osama bin Laden video comes out, you see three or four Muslim organizations put out a video in 48 hours saying this is what his Quranic scripture was that he mentioned. He said that capitalism is forbidden. It's actually incorrect. This is our interpretation. And then demanding that the media show that. So reach out to media, reach out to interfaith organizations, reach out to business community. But you need to start telling Americans not to be afraid of discussing religion, that this is not religion. These are politicians that cloak themselves in religion. And that's what I try to tell our government. They say, oh, we can't get into religious debates. I'll say that this is not a religious. Nobody's telling you to open the Quran and debate their interpretation. Nobody's telling you to tell them how to pray or how to do their spiritual path. What you're telling them is to engage them on government, period. So go to the Council on American Islamic Relations website, go to the Islamic Society of North America's website, go to MPAC and other groups, and you won't see spiritual paths on their websites. You're going to see politics. So why our government can't engage them on politics in the name of faith doesn't make any sense to me. Yes.
My name's Pat Savidov. I've changed my question so many times. But the you seem to want a spiritual and a cultural reformation. The cultural, obviously, is from tribalism to individualism, as I see it. The spiritual, though, you're talking... It's not clear to me where there is a place that states the spiritual values of Islam. You say the Quran, but that's most people, most non-Muslims are not going to read the Quran. So is there any place where there is a statement of the actual values and how your view fits in with those values? Is there a book? Is there a website and so forth?
That's actually something that we at our organization determined that we need to do more of is, you know, the way to reassure America is to tell them what our values are, is to tell them that we believe in the Ten Commandments, that we believe in the values that were taught from our parents at kindergarten about loving your neighbor and honesty and integrity. But now, where would you get that from? There's no site that I can refer you to. I would tell you to have this conversation with Muslims. I can give you, you know, one of the translations that I use is Arbery's translation. Even Muhammad Esed's translation of the Quran does get into a lot of these things. But again, I've always said, though, that the values that a person has, they're not going to get from a book. The values that we each have as individuals is from our superego, from our conscience that we get internally. So you take an Al-Qaeda terrorist and he reads the Quran, he's going to get something different out of it than a God-fearing Muslim that is humble and believes in universal religious values. So what these values are, I think that all of our faiths may have a hard time directing you to a place where that would list a prioritization. You know, one of the things I am schooled in is bioethics, and we have in bioethics one of the things that we came up with is a prioritization of autonomy, beneficence, non-maleficence, and just this ranking of different principles in bioethics. And unfortunately, I think the Muslim leadership has been asleep in giving a importance to different principles that need to be applied from a spiritual aspect. But I do think that they're there. But I can't point you to one website. And actually, I don't know if I want to. I never want to see the day when one central, supposedly moderate caliph speaks for Islam. And I think most of our faiths would never want that. You don't want centralization. You want each individual to speak for their own groups, for their own organization, but never for the whole faith.
Yes, hey, I'm afraid we've got time for just one more, so this gentleman will have the
last. My name is Wolf. I was a bubblehead. And... I saw you through a periscope, so I feel sorry that you were a target. But only from the Navy could such courage come, and I want to thank you.
Thank you.
And I truly, from the heart, want to thank you.
Thank you.
But I do have a couple disturbing questions. I am not a theologian, But there is a concept in Islam called Dar al-Ahab and Dar al-Islam. And there is also another concept called abrogation, which has to do, I may be wrong, which has to do with the latter passages in the Quran taking precedence over the former. I am an American who happens to be a Jew, and some of those latter passages are quite ugly. How do you, as a non-cleric, get around that stuff?
Good questions. I see quite a bit of that on the internet, on the blogs and things like that. First question about Dar al-Harb, which means the land or the area of war, and then Dar al-Islam. Again, this is the problem with today's world is that we are dealing in 7-second sound bites or 2-minute sound bites, and to answer that question appropriately needs a whole course in Islamic history. But basically, after the Prophet passed, he had not identified a successor. His initial successors were 4 caliphs that are called the rightly guided caliphs. But even those caliphs certainly did not lead democracies. They led benevolent caliphates, as they could be called. Certainly the Islamic world was not a purely defensive spread. There was an offensive spread of that. But if you believe that the Prophet Muhammad was moral, which I do believe, and if you believe that the caliph, such as Abu Bakr, was a moral person, then you would believe that what they called the intifa, or the opening of society, which was their reason to invade and to spread Islam, that was done preemptively. And to be fair, what we did in Iraq, which I support completely, and I still support, because I don't believe you're going to fix Islam without getting rid of those dictatorships, and I supported the offensive, and I still believe we need to be there and stay there. I do believe that preemption is a similar argument, in that we live in a land of freedom and that we wanted to help bring people that were living under oppression into freedom and liberty. So depending on whether you view the Prophet as moral, depending on how you view some of the historical stories of Islam, and at the end of the day, there may be some in the audience that are not going to come to agreement with me about the Treaty of Hudaybiyah or the Battle of Badr or any of this stuff that is part of Islamic history. We may not come to an agreement. But I think what is important that you feel comfortable with other Muslims is that the version that I give you is one that makes sense from just war theory and makes sense from one of morality and principle of today that isn't at conflict with me as an American citizen. So we may not be able to agree on the details because history books are rife with 10 or 12 different versions. But Dar al-Harb was a sense that everywhere that there was Islam, there was peace. And today, for example, if you read Barnett's book on foreign policy, where he talks about the division of the world into freedom and non-free societies, that was the way the world was divided then, was based on Islam and non-Islam, and it was felt that the non-Islamic worlds wanted to battle the Islamic worlds. That concept is not only archaic, it's harmful to today's society, but Muslims haven't reformed it, and it's basically where their information is stuck. I think that if I was living in the 9th century, I would probably, as Maimonides called the history of the Jews as being the golden age of his work was then, and Paul Johnson in the book The History of the Jews calls the golden age of Judaism as being under Islamic Spain. So there certainly was, if you wanted to live anywhere in the world at the time, it might have been the best place to live. But compared to American freedom, it's backwards and oppressive. The second question you asked was about abrogation. Very important question. I'll tell you, I believe, and this is how I was taught my theology, is that there are only one or two passages that were abrogated. And those passages, or nasakh in Arabic, God specifically abrogated them and said that this passage I'm giving you today cancels an earlier passage. One of them, for example, is alcohol. Muslims don't drink. The ones that practice Islamic theology. Earlier in the Quran, in the early passages, God permitted alcohol drinking. And then went through 3 stages. The second stage, God then told Muslims, well, you can drink, but just don't go to your prayers drunk. And then later, there's the last passage, he says, you've failed me, you're 5 times a day, that your daily prayers that you do, you're not doing appropriately, so you need to stop drinking, and he forbade wine. That is a passage that he specifically says to Muslims, I've canceled it. The concept of abrogation, and what you're saying is correct, in that the last passages of Islam before the Prophet passed were the ones in which he he discusses the permission to militarily fight the pagans and the return to Mecca. And in that return, there are some passages that says, you know, fight them where you find them, and if you, you know, you're given permission to do that. That is what I still believe, through just war theory, is a permission to fight as a last resort, if they don't come out of their homes, if they don't fight you, if it's a self-defense, et cetera, et cetera. But that doesn't abrogate all the previous peaceful passages before it. It simply is done in the context of Medina and Mecca at the time. And there's many scholars that would agree with me, whether it's Muhammad Taha or An-Na'im or others that would agree that you can't abrogate simply because, and that's what Osama bin Laden wants to do, is cancel the previous peaceful passages. And that doesn't make any sense, is that to me, God initially, before he even gave Muslims the right to defend themselves, wanted to establish the morals that were part of the faith, and then permitted war because he understood that sometimes the only way to prevent the complete eradication of a faith community, as the people of Israel determined and other peoples of God's faith determined, was to give them the ability to fight and defend themselves militarily, but it must be done morally. So I actually, other than when God specifically says it, if you believe in abrogation, you are empowering the jihadists. And I would never do that. God's word to me is in total. You cannot have the same God allow me to marry Christians and Jews as the most holy institution. He allows us to marry Christians and Jews, and then in another passage say that they're infidels. That doesn't make any sense. So somewhere we have to come to one interpretation of that. Thank you.
I think we can all agree on the interpretation that we've had a splendid afternoon and evening with Dr. Jasser, and we are now at the end of the 12th templated lecture. Thank you for coming.